Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And, well, we're at that time of the year again where sugar plums are dancing in our head.
And they're certainly dancing in this program.
Yes.
Because this is, a program all about sweets and cake and unforgettable desserts and a wonderful, exciting new cafe venture with sweets and savories and stuff like that, planning to open up in the Washington, D.C. area as well, although we don't know exactly where yet. So it's going to be, I think, a very interesting program, one that will set you in the right mood.
Yeah, they're all tops in their sweets field.
Tops in their field. And top of the heap, although it's really hard to choose, is a lady who's...
She is Miss Cake.
Miss Cake, Mrs. Cake, Dr. Cake, however you like to call her, Rose Levy Birnbaum.
Rose Levy Birnbaum, you are the go-to person for cakes. Well, for baking in general, but for cakes in particular. You wrote your iconic book, The Cake Bible, in, was it 1987? Because I know you won the your awards in 88.
That was actually written in 88. And it's so it makes it 21 years old now.
That's in the Stone Age, practically.
In the 80s.
But you know, the most miraculous thing is that it's in the 44th printing, which is actually the year I was born. So I think all the numbers are in perfect place.
Well, how different is this new book called Rose's Heavenly Cakes from the original Cake Bible?
It's actually entirely different, except for my what has become sort of a classic expectation, the charts, where I give the volume, the ounces in weight, and the ounces in grams, so people have the choice of all three. But what is really spectacular, literally, about this book is that the publisher was willing to put in over 100 full pages of color.
Okay.
So you can see 99% of the cakes, over 100 cakes, are photographed. So you can see inside the cake what the crumb looks like. And
you know, I wanted to ask you about that because I've noticed, we get a lot of cookbooks, as you can well imagine. I've noticed this trend, instead of having this picture-perfect finished product, the trend is to show the drips, the crumbs, the smooches, the cut pieces, and you even have one photograph where there's only one slice of the cake left.
Well, this is funny because we're in the era of reality, right?
Uh-huh.
Which is often not reality. But this book really is real. I mean, everything that was done is exactly the way it actually was done. But, Anne, I did something kind of unusual here, in that after the book was published, every week, every Wednesday, I published something originally I called Outtakes, but now I'm calling Outcakes.
Oh, how cute.
Isn't it? You know, I show the pictures of the behind-the-scenes things that we couldn't fit into the book, all the step-by-step things and what might be a problem and how to solve it. And then
do you put that on your website?
Yes.
On your blog?
Yeah.
Which
really
is
fun.
The address?
It's realbakingwithrose.com.
Uh-huh.
Now, I always ask silly questions like, how did you become an expert, such an expert in making cakes in the first place?
Well, it was by default, probably, because it goes back to the fact that my mother was a dentist. She went to Pitt.
She went to Pitt?
Yeah, she was the only woman in the entire dental school.
She went
oh, my goodness.
Isn't that dental amazing? School? How funny.
Yeah. Her mother had a candy store, and she brought me up.
Now, that was in Pittsburgh or in New York?
That was in New York,
okay.
And what happened was, well, she never baked. I mean, she made rock candy, but my mother certainly didn't want sweets around the house. So I wasn't exposed to all these wonderful things. And then when I was about 17 and I went to college, I had my first cake that was made from scratch, and I thought the flavor was amazing, but then I had a box mixed cake that didn't taste very good, but had the softest, most tender flavor. So it became a goal to have the two together.
Well, you're an absolute perfectionist, though.
Yeah, or a compulsive maniac, you know, as it were. But nobody seems to mind because when other people bake from my recipes, they get what I'm hoping for, you know, if they follow the instructions. So it kind of is forgiven that probably it was my personality problem that made me such a good baker. And I guess it's not a problem if you can put it to a good use, you know.
Right.
And now, do you actually have a day job?
No, this is my day job.
This is your day job.
This is how I've written 9 cookbooks.
Oh, 9.
It's
my
life.
Oh, I didn't. No, you see,
censor that one.
No,
and censoring him.
And steals the books away from me, so I don't know. I heard that you wrote one 21 years ago, and I thought, boy, 21 years later, she just wrote a second book.
Me think of the new doctor that I went to a couple of years ago when he asked me what business I'm in, expecting a routine answer to a routine question, and I said, the pleasure-giving business. And he looked up at me and said, my husband's colleague, for one thing. You know, he's expecting something very circumspect. But isn't that the truth? I mean, giving people the enjoyment of desserts, particularly cakes, and giving them the enjoyment of being able to make them themselves is the pleasure-giving business, right?
I guess. Now, you eat all of these cakes? I mean, you're really tiny.
Well, I eat a piece of them, but this is why if I have a leak in the apartment or any kind of problem, I don't have to wait very long for the repair people, and not just one comes, but usually three, sniffing the air, you know.
Well, I tell you what, when those Verizon guys come back, the ones who were banging just before we came on the air, when they come back and they're ready to fit out your house, be sure to offer them cake. I'm sure that they'll find all kinds of ways to make sure that you get the very best connections and the very best programming.
I'll take that to heart. As a matter of fact, I once offered a UPS guy a piece of cake, or cookie it was, and he said no, and I thought, wow, does he know what he's turning down? The poor guy. You know, maybe he's allergic. Who knows?
Oh.
But most of them do not say no.
Yeah, I imagine that. Yeah. Cookies, brownies.
Is this one of these things where you ask someone how they get to Carnegie Hall, and the answer is practice, practice, practice?
Well, I graduated from Carnegie Hall.
Oh, you did? Oh, my goodness.
As a matter of fact, you know, I went to Music and Art High School. That's the school part of performing arts.
One of my former best friends went there, yes.
Really? Maybe we were in the same year? Yeah. There are a lot of coincidences like that. At any rate, our graduation was held
in Ruth Reichel and I went to the same graduate school, University of Michigan, studying art history.
Oh, my stepdaughter went to U of M studying architecture.
Oh, wow.
And they're making cakes too, right? or they're slinging hash, or they're asking, would you like fries with that, sir?
People often don't go into the profession that they studied. I mean, I came about it totally indirectly. And I eventually went back to school, and I got my master's in food. But I never learned about cakes. I never learned about the science of baking or any of that. I sort of learned that on my own.
So it really is, in your case, it really is practice, practice, practice.
Yeah, really. My husband called me an alchemist for years, and I was insulted because I thought he meant, spinning straw into gold, that it wasn't a real science. But he told me, and it's taken 32 years to find out what he really meant, that the real scientists are the alchemists. They're the ones who actually do the applied thing. They actually bake the cake. They don't just theorize. And theories come and go, but when you see before your eyes what happens when you change an ingredient, when you use the wrong kind of flour, for example, like unbleached is not good for cakes, and the cakes will fall in the center after they come out, that's better than reading in a book somewhere something about what bleaching flour does, you know?
Well, you know, you have this very useful page, a section called Rose's Rules of Cake Baking, which many people don't realize how many other people using recipes modify them and then are startled by the fact that they don't get the right results.
Exactly. And the thing is, I'm not a rule follower. I was always a rebel. I mean, all of the people at Music and Art were, they were considered themselves artists, and rules are written for other people. But when people write to me on the blog and say, something didn't work, I did such and such. Like just yesterday, somebody wrote, I know the standard pan is 9x2, but I used one a little higher at 9x3. That's not a little higher.
I know.
That's 1.5 times. And then she wanted to know why the cake cracked at the top, why it was dry. You know, and the thing is, you can break the rules when you know what they are. When you try it the way they were supposed to be, if you change something, you can see if you like it better or if you don't like it.
Jazina Bullock, Sarah Bullock's sister.
Sandra Bullock's sister.
Yeah, Sandra. She talks about some man who was complaining about the yield, and it turns out he was eating the cookie dough.
Yeah, so he said a recipe that was supposed to make 36 only made 24 for him.
I think that people who go on blogs should have to sign a full disclosure clause first. You know, I'm telling you what I did before I tell you why it didn't work.
Well, she did get it resolved, and her advice was simply make enough dough to make 48. Now, do you come up with all the recipes, or do you borrow them from other people? I mean, there's a whole lot of different cakes here.
That's a very good question, and people are constantly sending me recipes, so there are not that many that get sent that get used in the form that they originally are. It's a very rare thing when somebody can send a recipe and say, here, you'll love this. But usually they send it saying, I love this, but it needs work.
Oh, okay. And so, you do the work.
Yeah, so I really cherish them because these are recipes I might never have known about, and I'm already writing my next book because people have responded from as far away as Melbourne, Australia, that they have a great cake that I'd never heard of before. When I was on tour in Montreal, I heard about the Queen Elizabeth cake I'd never heard of. I don't know if I'm going to like it or not, but sometimes when I don't like something, there's enough about it that is original that's worth tweaking, so to speak.
Well, who would ever know there's so many possibilities for cakes? I mean, it's just endless here.
Just so few ingredients, and that yet you can just...
But you have a new section. You never dealt with the oil cakes before,
right.
Did you?
Except for chiffon, because chiffon is an American cake that's kind of... it was invented by Harry Baker, and he was an insurance salesman from Los Angeles. And that's a cake made with oil, but... I'm really talking about, I know you're talking about the layer cakes, the ones that normally are made with butter.
I mean, I know Gina De Palma, that was one of her specialties, the olive oil cakes.
See, I've never liked olive oil cakes because I don't want the taste of olive oil with sugar. I like it with savory. Although I have to say, she's one of my favorite pastry chefs.
She's such a
sweetheart. And her goat cheesecake is the best cheesecake I've ever had.
Goat cheese, that sounds really great.
Mm, but it isn't goaty tasting is the thing. I mean, it's possible to mix the savory with the sweet. For example, to have salt with caramel, it can bring out the flavor. But I don't happen to like something as strong as olive oil or even lard. I love lard and pie crusts, but I don't like them with an apple pie. I like it with savory pie or quiche.
Really? Because, I mean, the big hot thing is reverting to lard again in pies,
As health. Well, see, that's why you can't believe any of these theories. You just have to do things in moderation. And I think that the less processing that food goes through, the better off it is, and I think the world's coming around to that same realization.
You talk also about how your new perspective is the less is more, the simpler the decorating, the better it is.
Yes, and this is another thing that's different from this book. See, the Cake Bible had a lot of decorative cakes to show people how to decorate, a lot of different elements that you could choose from, and to me, it's really a Bible because it's my reference book. It has all the basic types of cakes. But with this book, you don't have to jump all around to put things together. Each recipe is whole in itself. And I find I wasn't trying to do it. I was discovering that I like simpler cakes. I like cakes that don't need frosting because they're moist enough and flavorful enough that you don't need to adorn them with anything, especially if you bake them in a tube pan that has fluting. It can be so beautiful to look at, you don't want to cover it.
Yeah, those pans are amazing, aren't they?
It's really changed
the
way I
bake. Was it a pine cone cake you have in here that I thought was so beautiful?
Oh, that doesn't need a cake. That doesn't even need a pan.
No, it's just gorgeous.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
See, that's one of my outcakes because we just showed part of it, like one third of the finished cake, in the process of making those quills with a chocolate fondant.
Uh-huh.
And I thought it'd be fun to see the entire thing. So that's what I put up last week.
Now, here's an intriguing one, a Catalan salt pinch cake.
Yeah, I got that when I was in Barcelona. It was from one of the famous cooking schools there in Girona, which is where that famous chef, El Bulli, started the foam.
Right.
He's actually in Roses. He's a little bit away from Girona, but it's close by.
Right.
Right.
I heard a harrowing trip on the side of a cliff or something.
Yes,
like that.
It is indeed.
That's
You've
the one.
Been there.
Yeah, I just read they're opening a molecular gastronomy cooking school in Barcelona.
Yeah, I read that too. And you know, my book is supposed to be published, the Cake Bible is supposed to be published in Barcelona. They actually got the rights to it. And luckily, the flour in Spain works the way ours does. In France and in England, you have to go through actually heat treating it or bleaching it.
Really?
Unless you're in industry. Yeah, because it's so important to have the bleached flour in for most of the cakes. Not for cakes that are sponge type cakes, but for any of the layer cakes that have either oil or butter, it really makes a big difference and the flavor is a lot better as well. But you know, I made an amazing discovery 2 weeks ago when I was making my stepdaughter's birthday cake. My favorite cake in the new book is golden lemon almond cake.
Oh, that sounded good, yeah.
It's my favorite non-chocolate one, so I hope that's the first one that you'll make. And I was making hamburger buns, and of course for bread you want unbleached flour because you need it to be stronger and you have a little bit of chew to it. And I didn't notice, because the bags looked so similar, that I'd used it in the cake. You know, I'd gone to all the trouble of doing everything perfectly and then it was in the oven with the wrong flour.
Oh,
first of all, it browned more quickly because bleaching lowers the protein, it destroys some of the protein. So unbleached flour is a higher protein and higher protein brown zester. But that was okay. I just thought, now it's going to fall on the center. And then I realized, in a kind of eureka moment, it doesn't have a center. It's in a tube pen, so it can't fall. So then I had my recipe tester in Minnesota try it side by side. And he said, yes, as long as you use a tube pen, it's fine. But the flavor, it's not quite as tender, of course. And it also doesn't have quite as good a flavor. But if people can only get unbleached flour, the solution is the tube pan. So you see, one keeps learning, and these little things make a huge difference.
How did you get this recipe tester in where is it?
In Minnesota?
Yeah,
cities?
It's a little, I didn't understand quite how you two connected.
Well, it was through the internet. And I did write about him in the book because
yeah, I saw
it's
that.
Such a major contribution. But I guess
and
I
you
didn't
said your
really
husband isn't jealous of him even.
No, because he sees what a great adjunct he's been to my work. Like, I've been working alone, and poor Elliot would come home, and I'd have to say, could you please taste this or smell this, or, you know. And now I have somebody who's retested and tested umpteenth time every recipe in the book, and it wouldn't have worked long distance before the technology became what it is. But we both have the same digital camera, and he can even send me a motion picture of the texture.
Oh, isn't,
yeah.
Isn't
that amazing?
Absolutely amazing.
There's so much to talk about with this book. It's just gorgeous.
Well, what I thought it would be a good idea to have Rose do is to help our listeners understand how the book's organized. Because if you've got more than 100 cakes, I mean, how are you going to find the right one for the occasion or the right one with a particular ingredient? Is the book organized so that people can use it like that?
You know, this has the best index and the biggest one of any book that I've ever done. And I'm so glad that it makes it very easy when you're looking by ingredient. And it's interesting because in the past, when I would organize the book, my editor would always reorganize. She'd say, no, this really belongs better here or there. But this time, not a single thing was changed, and I guess it's logical. You know, there's the butter and oil cake section, and then there's the sponge cake section. Then there's the one that's mostly flourless. I say mostly because, for example, tiramisu is one of the great cakes, but it does have ladyfingers. And the filling, which is the best part, could be served over figs, fresh figs. Or you could use ladyfingers that don't have flour in them. They do make alternate ones for people who don't want to have flour or can't. So there's that chapter of mostly flourless. Then there's the baby cake chapter with all the cupcakes and the little...
Yeah, when are we going to get past cupcakes? Do you have any idea? Probably never, right?
What's this one here you have it open at? It looks like pretzels on end.
Oh, that you'll love that, because that is the wedding cake chapter. And there are two special things in it. One is that this is my new chocolate chiffon type of cake that is so incredible that I have it as a baby cake, as a cupcake, as a regular cake, and, I mean, regular size one, the base of the German chocolate cake, and also for a wedding cake. And that wedding cake that has chocolate twigs on it...
That's the one.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's sitting on the milk glass plate that belonged to my mother.
Oh,
right. Little scallops were where the dental instruments would hang off. And when she retired, she said, maybe someday you can use it for a cake. When the prop stylist came to my house, he didn't know any of this. He looked at it and he said, that will be great for the chocolate cake. So you can imagine that incredible shiny glaze. Your listeners who aren't looking at it can see it against that milk glass, and then the black background is just stunning. And then one of the most exciting new concepts in the book, in the wedding cake chapter, is the groom's cake.
Oh, yes.
I baked a brownie into a chocolate cake, so it looks like a mosaic. You have all those gooey pockets of brownie with walnuts, or you can leave out the walnuts. But the interesting thing is that nuts don't suspend in a cake. They usually drop to the bottom.
Right.
But when you make a brownie and then break it up and fold it into the batter, it stays where you put it. So you get the nuts suspended and the pockets of, my mouth's watering, of gooey chocolate in with a tender cake. Oh, and it's baked in the stadium pan. Because I was thinking that the right-size pan...
You know, who did that? Somebody designed that, huh?
I designed it for Nordic Ware because I said, you know, you have a wonderful daisy cake pan that is easy to serve. It's a rectangle. But I don't think most guys would appreciate having that as their groom's cake. So why don't you do something, like, related to football? And they did. Isn't that marvelous?
Oh, it's great, yeah.
And then you can spray it from a little atomizer with Maker's Mark.
Oh.
Bourbon.
That sounds like a wonderful idea.
It's worth getting married for that cake. It's worth making the cake, even if you're not getting married.
Well, I mean, I can't rave enough about this book. It's just, it's beautiful. It's delicious. Mm-hmm. It's thorough. It's no fail, I think.
Thanks. I hope so, Anne. You know, of all my books, it's certainly the most beautiful. It's even stitched so it can never fall apart. And the cover happens to be one of the top, out of the top 10 of all books, not just cookbooks, on Amazon. And if you vote for it by December 17th, I'm hoping it will be the winner, which would be really amazing. It's the only cookbook cover that's in the final judging.
Oh, I didn't even know they did that.
Yeah, I remember seeing how well it scored when I was putting it on our website, because the Amazon ranking comes up when you go to Amazon to get the information. So
it's like the stock market. I mean, I can't stay away. Every hour it changes, and every hour I look. It was 8 at one point, and then I told my father, who's 95, and he just couldn't understand why being a lower number is better. You know, but and right now I think it's 55. It jumps all over the place. I have to stop looking.
Well, as a final thought, let's do this. Out of all the cakes in the book, you're now about to have a cup of tea after your lunch. What cake are you going to serve yourself?
It happens to be that golden lemon almond cake, which is my favorite non-chocolate cake in the book,
right,
also goes perfectly with tea.
Uh-huh.
Not to say a chocolate cake wouldn't, because chocolate and tea can be wonderful, but lemon and tea, you know, lemon and almonds, yeah, that's what I would do.
Well,
or
Rose,
the whipped cream cake.
Rose, thank you so much for joining us on the menu today.
Thanks, rush out and get this one.
Yeah, you set a new standard in cakes. And I think that the 10th book is going to be on its way very soon.
Uh-huh.
So I'm sure we'll talk to you again when that comes out.
I hope so. Thank you, Peter.
Rose, it's just beautiful,
really,
and good luck with it.
Thank you so much.
Thanks. Oh, that book is just absolutely amazing. And so is she, the grand lady of cakes. Anyhow, it's now time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And this is the point in the program where we always say, keep in touch.
Keep in touch, especially since it's Christmas.
Yes. Anyhow, we're devoted to sweets, all you sweet teeth people out there. And I guess the next guest's title says it all, Damn Good Sweet. But then again, it doesn't say it all, because the subtitle is Desserts to Satisfy Your Sweet Tooth, New Orleans Style. And David Glass is based in D.C. right now, but in reality, he's a good old Nolens boy, and that's how he's going to tell you about sweets in New Orleans style. Let's listen. Damn Good Sweet. Now, that's a title. Hello, David Grass.
How are you?
Okay. David is a pastry chef in D.C., originally, however, born and bred in New Orleans.
That's right.
And he's just produced this book called Damn Good Sweet after his company, which is Damn Good Sweet, right?
That's right.
And it's subtitled Desserts to Satisfy Your Sweet Tooth. What you get in this book, if I'm correct, David, is you get sort of a tour of New Orleans, and you get the recipes for their iconic desserts. Is that correct? Is that your
Indeed.
Purpose?
Yeah, it's a book with recipes, stories, and it is. It's a tour of the city as I know it, or as I remember it. In many instances, it's some things that I talk about are no longer there. But it is. It's a good mix of the classic desserts that sort of everybody knows about that region of the world. But then there are also some very personal recipes of mine.
Which are those?
Well, things like the crepes de vieux carré and the Gap's fried apple pie. Gap's
that was your aunt.
Yeah, the great aunt Patty. And the sweet potato tartatin is not a classic New Orleans or Louisiana dessert, so that's definitely sort of a twist of mine. And
I thought that was something I had missed. I'd never had that in New Orleans. I thought it was very clever.
Right. There's, you know, it's probably about half of the classics, and then the other half are things that are just very specific to my upbringing.
Now, you were a native New Orleans?
Born and raised, yep.
And then so you started cooking there?
I did, at the Windsor Court Hotel.
And it's a great hotel. We interviewed the pastry chef there about 4 years ago, something like that. She was a blonde young lady. She was very good.
Mm-hmm.
She and her husband had moved. They were destined to go there.
Sure.
Because they decided to go there right after Katrina.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't even thinking about it, and then they up and decided, Well, we're just going to go to New Orleans because we need to be there.
Sure. And well, I know exactly who you're talking about.
You do. She did a wonderful job talking about pastry chefing in a way that I didn't understand. She was the first person that I think we interviewed who made it clear to me just how precise you needed to be in
exactly.
making dessert. It looks sometimes it looks sort of slap happy, but it's really not.
Well, you know, on that note, you know, it's a great point that you made, because desserts in the professional world and at home, you know, they are. And I think that the fears that a lot of people have about baking are about the precision and the accuracy and the weights and the measures. And you know what? Once you learn some very basic do's and don'ts as far as how to scale things, whether it's a cup measure or if you're using an old mason jar and you know it's 8 ounces, whatever your sort of tool is, if you will, this book, Damn Good Sweet, talks about and really helps to sort of break down those sort of those fears that people have about getting in the kitchen and experimenting with baking. There is precision, and I do, you know, obviously have recipes and formulas, but at the same time, I also, in my tips, talk about the things you can do outside of what I suggest. So, you know, if you don't have this, use this instead, and if this isn't exactly the way it's supposed to look, this is what you're looking for, don't worry about it, do this with it. Or if there's a couple tablespoons left over of this mix, you know, fold it or mix it into some milk and use it for a hot chocolate on a hot... Different things that I sort of make it a little bit more lighthearted when things sort of... while you're in the kitchen, especially when it comes to the desserts, because you're right, it is based on precision and accuracy, and so...
What do you think of Michael Ruhlman's book and his theory of ratios?
I think there's a lot to be said for it. I mean, it's what makes the world go round. But when you have a base formula and you know it works, there are some things you can play with. And, for instance, you know, sugar in general. I mean, generally you can't just start, you know, removing a half a cup of sugar from every cake recipe because you want it a little less sweet, or you can't just completely sub out for Splenda or something like that. So there are some things that you obviously can't do. But, for instance, in an icing, you know, removing, you know, an extra couple cups of powdered sugar in your red velvet, you know, it's not going to be the end of the world. And, you know, you may be able to taste the cream cheese better. So
we had somebody on the other day who has recipes on our website. I forget who it was. And she said she had one person who called her.
Oh, that was funny.
Who
yeah.
was complaining seriously
that
because
was Bullock,
the recipe never came out.
Oh, boy.
And then she discovered that what happened was this guy liked eating the dough. He liked eating cookie dough.
Right.
So as a result, a recipe that was supposed to make 36 of these things only produced 24. And she said he didn't even understand until he talked to her about that.
He was just nibbling here and there.
He was nibbling here and there
throughout the process, mm-hmm. and then didn't have the proper yield, huh?
So she said it was really very simple. If you want to make 36, make enough to make 48, and then you'll be able to satisfy your inner craving.
There you go. No, you gotta sample throughout the.
Yeah. Well, you do. Okay.
Well, I love your photos. I mean, is this a new trend in photography, food photography? You show your chocolate pudding, for example,
right.
with a big scoop out of one of the little crocks.
Exactly.
And then the dirty spoon on the table.
Of course. Well, for me, that Silverman did an unbelievable job portraying my style, a very welcoming feeling when you look at some of these desserts. And that, again, was part of the strategy of didn't want things to be overly pristine because, you know, you talk about the accuracy and the precision of baking, and also the dessert world, especially in the professional world, there's an emphasis on, you know, just things being exact all the way down to the presentation. And I didn't want that. You know, I've got my 13 years of experience in a la carte world, and I wanted my first book to be one that you want to jump into the picture and just dive into the chocolate pudding. Or,
well, somebody did this with your chocolate chip cookie cake because it looks like somebody took a big bite right out of it.
Right. And then smeared the chocolate. Exactly.
Yeah. And then the other one,
put together well.
The other thing I liked was you showed a glass of wine that was almost empty. Nobody does that. I think that's wonderful.
Yeah, I agree. She did a wonderful job executing my vision and what we wanted. We wanted some great natural textures of burlap sacks and knotted reclaimed woods, but I wanted a lot of crumb, and I wanted a lot of dirty spoons, and she did a great job. I mean, even the cup custard's got a giant bite taken out of it. And
well, was the dust jacket deliberately put on backwards?
No. It was not.
Is it on back?
No, I turned it around, but I mean, it threw me for a loop because I read the inside of the jacket covers, and they were in the right place, and then I opened it to the index.
Now, this must have been a faulty piece of assembly when the book was sent out. Now, what are you up to these days? You followed Jeff Tunks.
I did.
Who you worked with at the Windsor Court.
And, I love Jeff.
And let's put in a good old plug for the good old Windsor Court anyway, because
sure.
It still sets a really mean table, even though David and Jeff aren't there anymore.
Right, right.
So you worked for the D.C. Coast Group.
That's correct. I left New Orleans in February of 98 to move to D.C. specifically to help Jeff open his first restaurant with his partners, D.C. Coast, as his pastry chef. And we opened in June of 98, so just a few months after we all got up here. He took two other gentlemen from the Windsor Court to be the opening chef team, one of which is still with him today, and then the other one is off to Atlanta, his hometown, and has three restaurants already. But, yes, every couple of years we were opening restaurants with the group, and so I opened Ten Pen, then Saba, then Acadiana, just in that order, which brought us up to September of 05 with the opening of Acadiana. So I was running the four as his executive pastry chef and was with Jeff for almost 10 years here in D.C. and then almost 2 years in New Orleans. So
you refer to it as family. Like when you went on to your own consulting work, set up your own company, you said it was like leaving family.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I gave him some obnoxious amount of time, a 10-week notice or something like that, you know, 2.5 months, and it's difficult. And for me, it was purely to see what else was out there for myself. Never imagined leaving a group like that treated me so well to sort of take up another sort of restaurant position somewhere here in town.
So what are you up to now?
Well, I'm still consulting. I've been eagerly and frantically at this point looking for the perfect space for my bakery concept called Bayou Bakery. And I'm looking far as Capitol Hill to the Northern Virginia area of Courthouse and Clarendon of Arlington. So I'm out there every day with a broker and looking at least 3 or 4 sites a week.
Wow.
And in the meantime, I still do consulting, helping restaurants on their dessert menus and also savory menus as well. I do a lot of consulting with bar menus and bar snacks and pickled items and candied nuts and things like that, and just fun, innovative things, and also can help with the cocktail menus and things like that. So
now that Courthouse area has to be a great location. I was doing some consulting work, and my client was in that area, so I stayed at a new Residence Inn by Marriott.
That's sure.
Just sort of between the two metro stops, the Courthouse and then the next one going out. I forget its name now. And it looked like a really hopping area.
Clarendon.
Clarendon
is sort of the next one further west. It's booming.
And there seems to be so much activity going on there. I'm sure that whatever you do there, if it's good, which is going to be, is going to be a smashing success. Now you're in D.C. Okay, so what are you doing as a contribution to the nation in trying to sweeten the tempers on Capitol Hill, for Christ's sake?
Yeah, really. Well, you know, I'm just trying to get the bakery open, which is really an all-day concept. And I actually have a lot of people on my team. They're, you know, other brokers that just want to see me have a space and aren't even looking for anything in return. And I've actually got a Louisiana senator who is pretty adamant about where she would like for me to be location-wise in proximity to her residence.
Well, you have some fierce competition there with the, what's his name, the Ace of Cakes?
No. He's doing something completely different. So, and I would never, he's in Baltimore.
Oh, that's right.
But Bayou Bakery is a strong coffee program, really focused on a house blend and espresso drinks and the art of that. Along with all the wonderful desserts and sweets you would know about the South, you know, obviously beignets being one of the signature items, which, you know, really no one else in the city are doing, you know, beignets fried to order, and doing it 3 per order, just like our good friends down in the quarter at Dumont, and really going into a lunch menu of great sandwiches, you know, great muffalatas.
Oh, you can draw that, huh?
Oh, yeah, muffalatas, you know, an olive salad and you know, pressing the muffaletta, which is a little different than normal, and po' boys and things like that, salads and great soups, gumbos, you know, artichoke and oyster soup.
Oh, well,
and
David, you better keep us, because I told you we're due, we've been invited to do a sweep of that area, the D.C. area.
Great.
And we'd want to know what your progress is, so
of
you'll
course.
Keep us posted so we can include you in that?
Most definitely.
There's a definitive New Orleans dessert called Bananas Foster.
Sure.
Is that in the book?
Yes.
Of course.
Why don't you take our listeners through how they can make this for themselves?
Okay.
And well, also the banana connection. With
exactly. Well, obviously the bananas were a huge import into the port of New Orleans hundreds of years ago, coming from, you know, Central America, just like the coffee was coming from different regions as well. See, New Orleans being a huge port city. So the bananas were one of those things that always very plentiful there, and it was their first stop in the U.S. was always New Orleans. And good old Owen Brennan from the Brennan family had named this after a friend of his with the last name of Foster. And still today at Brennan's, you get the beautiful Gueridon and the waiters in tuxedos, and they're doing the whole sideshow for you at tableside, which is quite an experience.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I love it because a lot of people's kitchens these days in their homes, whether or not they're recently renovated or sort of any type of new architecture, seems like people are wanting open spaces and open kitchens and not really just, there's no more sort of hinged doors and the kitchen's back there kind of thing. It's really about sort of open wide space, a dining room to your living room to your kitchen generally. So mine in particular is that way as well. So for me, I don't want to be in the kitchen while everybody else is out there, you know, having a good time. And I can drink my bourbon in the kitchen, but it's not the same if you can't have interaction with other people. So, and then the other thing about desserts and entertaining is, you know, a lot of times things need to be a la minute to be, you know, truly appreciated. So this is a great a la minute dessert. It's essentially a pan dessert, a sauteed dessert. And I start by just melting a little butter in a saute pan. And it could be Teflon, it could be non-Teflon, just throw some butter in there. And
A lot of butter.
That's a good way to start. And then I already have my bananas sliced lengthwise in half and sort of piled up, ready to go. And generally I'll cut those in half as well. So out of one banana you'll get, you know, four pieces. And then a little bit of brown sugar. If you like cinnamon, you could do a dash of cinnamon. And then I throw the bananas in there, toss them around. I'll throw some roasted pecans in there. And then, just as they're starting to get tender, I'll add a little bit of banana liqueur and also some rum. And just as I'm doing that, this sort of, you tilt your pan up and you get a nice little igniting of the alcohol and you get a little flame. And that's sort of the what I call the showboat part and the fun part to sort of entertain. And you've got all your bowls lined up and you've got your vanilla ice cream ready to go. And that's essentially the 5 minute. You know, Bananas Foster. It's a really quick, wonderful dessert that is beyond season. So it could be 110 degrees in the Big Easy, or it could be 40 degrees on a nice fall day in Virginia. So
now, do the bananas have to be really ripe? Is it better with really ripe bananas?
They do need to be somewhat firm, but I definitely wouldn't suggest ever green bananas. But the browning bananas are meant to be held in the freezer for banana bread, or banana cake, which I also have a recipe for.
Yeah.
So, yes, you want to shop out nice, firm bananas just turning yellow.
Now, your father was famous for his recipe for Bananas Foster, huh?
He did his baked bananas, yeah.
His background is Cuban, huh?
That's right. He was born and raised in Cuba. He had a Louisiana mother and a Cuban father. And
he was a veterinarian?
Veterinarian, yep.
Here's a tip for you. Here's something we just tried for the first time in a restaurant we like in England.
Sure.
And I'm sure they won't mind if you borrow the recipe. This is foie gras done with bananas.
Excellent.
And it was really good.
It was good.
Made in heaven, sounds like to me.
It was absolutely delicious. I mean,
sure.
Anne wasn't sure about it because she doesn't have the sweetest tooth in the world.
Right.
But it sure worked out well.
It worked well, yeah.
Great. No, I love wonderful fruit-based dessert types paired with a good slab of seared foie gras.
There you go.
Oh, dear. David, do you have a website that people could check out?
Most definitely. It's www.damgoodsweet.com. And I'm also doing a chat starting next Friday. It'll be from noon to 1, where you can write in your baking questions for the holidays. And we were doing it on Sundays and decided to move it to Fridays, right at most people's lunch hour on the East Coast, and also to sort of help involve the West Coast as well, because before we were doing it 9:30 on Sunday morning, it just sort of ruled out part of the country. So, no, it's proven to be successful so far, and you can go on the website and click on the red velvet cake, and that'll bring you right to the chat.
Well, it's been a pleasure meeting you. As I said, I feel like I should have known you for a long time because of all our interconnectedness here.
Most definitely.
And I love the book.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, and please congratulate your photographer, because she did a fabulous job.
I do daily.
Oh, yeah.
And what's going to happen, listeners, is when David tells us when his shop is opening in D.C. or in Arlington, Virginia, or wherever it is,
we'll spread the word.
We'll be sure to let you know.
Wonderful.
So thank you, David.
Thank you
for
having me.
Have a good day.
Appreciate it.
And it's now time to take another break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are again, still talking about sweets. Now, anybody who watches television, especially PBS, but also things like the Today Show, or reads food magazines, will recognize the very popular Dee Dee Wilson, who is our next guest. And her book is something you'll recognize as something you need to have right away. Anyhow, it's called Unforgettable Desserts. Let's listen to Dee Dee.
Well, we're going to find out something that we all want to know about in the holidays. How can we really, with all the wonderful foods around us, and the wonderful sweets, how can we stand out? Well, we turn to a book by Dee Wilson called Unforgettable Desserts. Welcome to On the Menu, Dee.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, before we launch into the book, you have a very illustrious career in culinary arts. Tell us a little bit about your public television and your other books.
Well, thank you. I do have a few books under my belt. This is my 12th.
Just
a
few.
What I really like to point out to people is that I am self-taught. I grew up in a household with mother and father who loved to cook, not professionals, but just really loved to cook. And so I was around really good food, really good ingredients from the get-go. Didn't realize my palate was being honed at the time, but really that's what was happening. And I think that if you have a passion and a curiosity grew out of it, and I feel lucky that I do what I love.
Now, do you practice as a chef, Dee?
I absolutely cook as well as bake, but it's really the sweet pantry, as I like to refer to it, that gets my creative juices flowing. I love to bake.
Well, the book shows it. You have rather, of course, that's probably essential to baking, very precise techniques. I loved the section where you advised readers cooking from this book to be sure to follow your directions exactly. And you even listed some of the crazy things that people do with recipes that they should not do.
Baking is much more of a science than cooking. If you're making a pot roast and you decide to add some extra thyme, or maybe this time you want to use rosemary instead, I mean, everything's going to come out fine. But with baking, we can't be quite so freewheeling. The amount of leaveners is specific. The amount of dry to wet ingredients is specific. It's a formula. So what I usually suggest, or always suggest, is that hopefully a recipe has been written carefully. And I certainly take pain to do that. So if you're opening my book or another book or a magazine, I always tell people, make the recipe as written at least once. And then you can see what it was that the recipe developer was trying to produce.
Right, and then
make notes. You know, make notes for yourself. Oh, I would like to add raisins next time. Or this would be great with a little bit of cinnamon added. And in that way, you can start turning it into a recipe of your own. But you'll know where your baseline is.
Right. So you both give the big pitfalls of baking errors and encourage
experimentation on with their own well-reasoned out additions to make it their own recipe.
Exactly. I'll get emails from people who say they tried a cake, but it overflowed in the oven and made a mess, and they're admonishing me, and it turns out they used an 8-inch pan instead of a 9-inch pan, which is what I suggested. And that may not seem like a huge difference, but it's these kinds of attention to detail that really do make a difference. One of my favorite funny stories is a gentleman who wrote to me who was a chocolate chip cookie aficionado. He loved chocolate chip cookies. He's always experimenting with different versions. And he had tried a version from one of my books, but he complained that the yield was just not anywhere near what I said he would get. And he was planning on, I don't know, you know, he needed 36 cookies for his party or bake sale or whatever. And then halfway down in the email, he starts talking about how he loves eating the batter. So, you know, I thought, wow, do I really have to point out to him that maybe the reason he only got 24 cookies instead of 36 is because he was munching on the batter?
Oh, that's funny.
It actually hadn't occurred to him.
Oh, that's funny.
So you finally resolved the problem. He said, if in doubt, put in agreements to make 48.
That's right, double the recipe in his case.
No, the title is arresting, as I pointed out when I was introducing you. What? You have more than 140 of these dessert recipes. What makes them unforgettable, as your title suggests?
The title came about after the concept for the book. It was very interesting because what happened was my literary agent and the editor of the book, who I had worked with before, the three of us got together and they were asking me, Dede, what is it that makes your desserts different? Why is it that I could make a batch of brownies and you could make a batch of brownies, and if we both brought them in to the workplace, people would be going nuts over your brownies? And I started talking about what we just referenced. It's really the attention to detail. It's the attention to the ingredients. This is what, in the end, makes my brownies, that's what we're talking about at the time, maybe a step above. You know, maybe you skimped on the chocolate, maybe you didn't have the right flour, you decided just to go with it anyway. Certainly your brownies are going to be edible, they might even be delicious, but are they going to be stellar? And so we came up with this idea of having a whole book of recipes that would be unforgettable. Now the irony is it took us a long time to come up with that one word. Once we did, we realized that that should be the title. The one thing I want to point out, though, is this doesn't, unforgettable doesn't half complicated. It doesn't have to mean fancy or difficult. For instance, there's a recipe called hot chocolate truffle bomb. And this has three ingredients. It's simply chocolate, cream, and cocoa. And what it is you could even do it in the microwave. You could melt your chocolate and your cream together, making a ganache, letting it firm up, rolling it into truffles. But in this case, we're not making truffles as in truffle candies. We're making slightly larger sizes. They get tossed in cocoa, and what I use them for is sort of as a instant hot chocolate.
Oh.
So you have these particularly sized truffle bombs. They're a little larger than your average truffle. You can keep them in the fridge. You can keep them in the freezer. And then when you want hot chocolate, you can throw a couple of these bombs in a mug, top off with some milk. You can throw it in the microwave. And you've got instant hot chocolate that is so delicious.
Oh, it
because
sounds
you're going
great.
To, you're going to start with really good cream and really good chocolate. And so here's a perfect example of a really easy recipe, but because of the technique and the approach and what you're doing with it in the end is a little bit unforgettable and different.
So in a sense, when you're saying unforgettable, you're saying do it this way, and it will always be wonderful, and everyone will always think you're brilliant and all that kind of stuff. So it'll be unforgettable for your guests.
Exactly.
because you can be sure that it's going to be right.
Yes.
Well, you cover a lot of different desserts. I mean, it would take up the whole interview time if I went through all the classifications of this, cookies and bars and cakes and streusel and candy and so forth. And you address something that's really hot at the moment, mallow-mores, which is marshmallow s'mores, right?
Well, in the Northeast where I live in Massachusetts, we have these Malamar cookies. And they are, I believe, regional. They're called different things in different areas of the world, but it seems as
though... Yeah, we used to have a big Nabisco factory here, so I didn't know about those.
Yeah, you could smell them. When they were making them, you could smell it in the air.
That and Fig Newtons. Exactly. It is a cookie with a marshmallow topping, and it's cloaked with chocolate. And it is very much like a... commercially made s'more. And so I wanted to figure out how to do this at home. And I think people are fascinated when they realize that they can make marshmallows at home, because that's a big part of what this recipe calls for, is the marshmallow center. And it's not that hard. You do need a thermometer. It helps to have a candy thermometer. But there's just a little gelatin in there and egg whites and some corn syrup. It's really not that difficult.
Well, why is everybody so mad for marshmallows all of a sudden?
One of my theories is that it's one of those foods, those sweet foods, that because it's fat-free, people think they have carte blanche to munch on them. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, there's things like... I was just having this conversation with someone the other day about gummy candies. And is the fascination with gummy candies? I said, well, they're fat-free. People think they can just eat them by the handful. And I think marshmallows fall into that category.
Like Swedish fish.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I don't know about Swedish fish.
What? You don't know about that?
Swedish fish? Are they candies?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
They're jellies.
Oh,
you're missing out.
Oh, they're jellies. Okay.
Oh, there are people totally addicted to those. I mean, real people I've come across are addicted to those things.
Well, now, here's a difficult question for you. Obviously, any book has to be a certain size. So you measure 140-some recipes. Which ones did you leave out?
Good question.
It's a fabulous question because it allows me to tell your listeners that there were almost double the amount of recipes. Almost double. So I couldn't even list the ones we left out because there were so many. And the reason that happened was because I did take pains to write so much of the associated text that you were referencing before, that the informational text. That ended up taking up so much room that the publisher said, well, we have to cut something. And I said, well, we're not cutting that, because that is what is going to help people make the desserts that are in the book unforgettable. They do need that helpful information beyond just the recipes. So we ended up cutting dozens.
So I'm guessing that there's...
You have another book.
Yeah, I'm guessing that there's Unforgettable Desserts, the sequel.
Yeah, more Unforgettable Desserts.
Yeah, even more. In fact, there's even probably three books there.
Well, I wish it were so easy with the publishers. I guess we'll have to wait to see how this one sells. But yes, there's a lot left over.
You even tackle tempering chocolate, which, I mean, I did a chef's cookbook, and the pastry chef had me crazy over its tempering chocolate. I couldn't figure out how to explain it in a pinch.
Well, tempering chocolate, it isn't used in many recipes in the book, but it is in a few. And chocolate is an emulsion. It's made up of certain kinds of fats and other ingredients, and if all those molecules aren't lining up correctly, the chocolate's not going to have a great texture, and it's not going to have a sheen, and it's not going to have a nice snap.
Right.
Usually when we buy chocolate, it is in good temper, which is the phrasing that's used, but once you melt it, it goes out of temper. So what you have to do is you have to bring it up to a certain temperature, and then bring it down to a certain temperature, and then bring it slightly up again to another temperature, and that's really what it is, and that's going to allow your candies to have that beautiful, glossy look on the outside.
And I want to comment on the photographs in this book, too. I mean, it's the contemporary school of showing the crumbs and whatever, and they're so realistic, you want to eat the page.
Well, I know. Too bad they're not scratch and sniff, especially the cover. I love the cover. I fought for the cover.
That was beautiful.
The cover is one of the more complicated dishes.
That wrap thing, too, to get that pattern, right?
The cake on the cover is a chocolate cake that is wrapped with this lacy chocolate band. And then it's covered with caramelized clementine segments and these candied orange zests. But the reason why I wanted the cake on the cover, beyond the fact that it's a beautiful photo, is because I do hear from people a lot who buy my books, and I didn't want to talk down to them. There are a lot of people out there that are fabulous in the kitchen. They are up for a challenge. They want new ideas, new things to try. And this is what I call a project cake. This isn't something you're going to come home at 5 o'clock and decide to make. This is the kind of cake you're going to decide, you know what, my best friend's birthday is next month, and I'm going to plan, and I'm going to figure out which components I can make ahead and do it that way. And then maybe once you make it, I don't know, maybe you don't make it again, but then you know. I did that.
I made one of those. I've had project
baking in my past where I've done that, like strudel dough.
Yeah.
You do it by hand, and you do it once, and then you say, you know what, that was nice. Maybe next time I'll buy some frozen.
Exactly. I couldn't imagine making strudel.
Anne made this fabulous five-layer cake that had rum and chestnut cream and all kinds of things in it for a friend. Was a friend who had 40-some birthdays but never had a birthday party, she said. So we determined to give her one. And, of course, I was serving the entire group at the party, so I didn't get any of the dessert. And the next day I came around to find some and had taken it away and given it to her friends at the gym. And she never made it again.
Oh, no. It took forever. I mean,
At least you could have left me a piece.
Oh, dear. Oh, well.
Dee Dee, I know you. I know that you're joining us, even though perhaps your doctor advised against it. So we thank you for sharing your voice with us today, and also for sharing your ideas about this wonderful book, Unforgettable Desserts. And listeners, watch out for Unforgettable Desserts, the sequel, and Unforgettable Desserts Part 3 coming to a bookstore near you sometime in the next 5 years.
I'll cross my fingers.
Oh, yeah, Dee Dee, get well, too.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, that's it for another program, and we hope that you'll be inspired.
How
sweet it is. Wonderful sweet things for the holiday, whether it's Christmas or whatever holiday you celebrate.
We're sure that
this program will add something to that. And, of course, we wish you all the very happiest of holiday seasons. And we'll be back very soon after Christmas. And in the meantime,
bye-bye.